Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Uma. If you're a small business owner, now more than ever, you understand the importance of being able to adapt so you can always be there for your customers. Uma Office is a cloud-based business phone service that gives small business owners the flexibility needed to run a business efficiently from anywhere. With features like mobile and desktop apps, a virtual receptionist, and call recording, you can do more for less. Uma Office starts at $19.95 per user per month with no contracts. To learn more, go to uma.com or call 833-TRY-OOMA.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday the 9th of June, these are our main stories. Mourners gather in the US city of Houston for the funeral of George Floyd. India's Supreme Court orders the government to transport millions of migrant workers home. The hotline goes cold between North and South Korea. Also in this podcast, we hear from Sweden on the recent asylum seekers who've been through the school system, only to be told they could be deported if they don't find a job.
Kind of sounds ridiculous to think that somebody you have spent so much money and that's when you get stopped. It doesn't sound like a good business either.
And a fourth division football team plays its first game in 3 months in the semi-final of the German Cup. The killing of George Floyd, a black man who died while a Minneapolis police officer kneeled on his neck, has sparked more than a week of protests across the US and around the world, calling for racial justice and an end to police brutality. And later today, in his hometown of Houston in Texas, family and friends will pay their last respects at his funeral. The BBC's Jane O'Brien is in Houston.
The funeral, the final farewell, will be taking place in just a few hours' time. It is a private funeral. Only family members will be in attendance and some invited guests. But yesterday, we had somber scenes as more than 6,000 people came here to pay their respects at the last public opportunity to mark the death of George Floyd.
For several hours, a steady procession of mourners filed past the coffin of George Floyd. The vast majority never knew him, but they all felt a deep connection to the man who has become a catalyst in America's struggle with race.
It doesn't really hit home until you really see it for yourself. Just to see his senseless body sitting in a casket, you know, knowing he was helpless, no one was there to help him. With a police knee on his neck. It's horrendous.
To witness a person who went through a situation that was, you know, unfairly his life was removed from him, just being a part of that history meant a lot to me.
This is the last public gathering in honour of Mr. Floyd before the private funeral. Former Vice President Joe Biden has met with the family but won't attend the service. In Minneapolis, meanwhile, the city where George Floyd was killed, the white police officer charged with his murder appeared in court via video link. Derek Chauvin was remanded in custody and bail was set for $1.25 million. A majority of Americans, black and white, now say that police reform is an essential first step towards social justice for African Americans. There is certainly momentum. And as George Floyd is laid to rest, real hope that change will come.
Jane, emotional scenes there in your piece, but the vice presidential, well, the Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden, went to see relatives, and he also has a message for the funeral.
That's right, he does. He didn't want to disrupt the proceedings by having a major security detail here at a very sensitive time. So he recorded a message which will be played at the funeral later on today. But the debate is, of course, now about what does change look like? And it's a very complicated debate because of the fragmentation of police forces across the country. You have state police forces, you have municipal police forces, you have town police forces, even hospitals in America have their own police force. So when people start talking about reform and defunding the police, which is what a lot of people now want, what does that actually look like? Protesters are really encouraged by the fact that it's not just or not only an African-American protest. This is an American protest. We have seen so many white people out here, and there is certainly a real sense that the momentum for change is there. The issue and the challenge now for those protesters is how they can harness it and turn it into something meaningful.
Jane O'Brien speaking to my colleague Yelda Hakim, and we'll bring you more coverage of the funeral in our next edition. Millions of migrant workers in India found themselves without jobs when the country announced a lockdown back in March. Men, women and children were forced to begin arduous journeys back to their villages, walking, cycling or hitching rides. Now, the Supreme Court has given the authorities a deadline of 15 days to transport them home. I heard more from our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etarajan.
Now, some in India, the historians would describe as this as the biggest disaster after India's partition during the independence in 1947, when millions of people migrated from the divided India and to Pakistan. Because what we saw in the pictures on TV and on social media, these kind of migrant workers walking on these newly built highways under scorching sun, in a heat, with their families, with children, to their homes, hundreds of kilometers. There are people who even cycled all the way to about 1,000 kilometers far away from the home. So what happens? You know, India witnessed a phenomenal economic growth in the last 2 decades, but the backbone of this industrial economic growth was its migrant workers. We're talking about tens of millions of workers in different parts of the country. Now, the lockdown came as a big surprise because the government gave only a few hours' notice, and people lost their jobs, their livelihood, and people are earning about $7 to $8 a day. That was their maximum earning, and they lost the jobs with no other option. They thought going back home would be the safer option, and many people got stranded because the government did not allow them to travel at that time. Then there was no transport. They were put up in different camps. Many migrant workers died because of illness, exhaustion, and many road traffic accidents. Now, the Supreme Court is telling the authorities, you know, finish this process in the next couple of weeks so that these people can be allowed to go back to their homes.
Anbarasan, there have been some attempts to transport them home already.
After much criticism, after, you know, the migrant workers, you know, started violating these lockdown rules, saying it doesn't matter where you put us up because we're not getting any facilities, we want to go back to our homes. Then the government started running special trains and buses, you know, from the beginning of May. And the government says that it has already transported more than 10 million workers to their respective places. But still, there are many people stranded in different parts of the country. And that is why the court is now given the deadline. But some would, even in India, would say that it is a bit late because the migrant workers went through a lot of suffering, and the court is now intervening at the very end of this crisis.
Anbarasan Etarajan. As the coronavirus pandemic continues to cause thousands of deaths every day around the world, countries are counting the economic as well as the human cost. New figures show just how big that impact has been on the Eurozone's two biggest economies. Exports from Germany have plunged to their lowest level since records began 70 years ago, and the French economy is now expected to shrink by more than 10% this year. Our economics correspondent Andrew Walker says the figures aren't surprising.
It is broadly in line, I think, with what people expected. I mean, clearly when large parts of business are being shut down by official action, you're going to see some very large declines in industrial activity. We saw those figures over the last couple of days. And of course, there have in many cases been significant restrictions at borders, significant disruption to international transport. And inevitably, that's going to affect the flow of goods and services as well across borders. Germany, of course, is a very, very large exporting powerhouse. So no great surprise, really, that we've seen this a decline of almost 25% in 1 month. These are figures for the month of April compared with the previous month. And if you look at what's happened over the preceding 12 months, the cumulative decline was well in excess of 30%. Yes, so the biggest decline in German foreign trade figures since those figures were put together back in 1950 in the first instance.
And Andrew, is there any way of saying how quickly or indeed slowly, we can expect this to pass?
So much will depend on the path of the pandemic. Most forecasts are being done on the basis that there will not be a major second wave and that things will gradually return towards something like normality over the coming months. And the Bank of France, for example, has been indicating that it expects to see economic activity getting back to pre-pandemic levels very slowly indeed, so not until 2022.
Andrew Walker. The Russian capital has endured a very arduous lockdown, but now Moscow is lifting many of its restrictions. The city's nearly 13 million residents are free to go outside when they want, use public transport and travel in their own vehicles without any restrictions. Our Moscow correspondent is Sarah Rainsford.
Well, this was quite a surprise, really, I think, for many Muscovites, a radical change in what's been called the self-isolation regime here. Over the past 10 weeks or so, suddenly the mayor came out yesterday and said that self-isolation was over. So people out on the streets today, free to go where they want, to see who they want, to do what they want for the first time in a very long time. People driving cars as well. Until now, you had to get a permit to use your car. You could only go out twice a week if you're going to the shop. So a huge amount of restrictions, a very strict lockdown, has suddenly ended. There are changes happening today. We still have to wear masks on the streets. That is supposed to be mandatory, but many people don't actually wear the masks, most of them supporting them, using them to support their chins by the look of it. You have to wear gloves if you head into shops, which are already open. So things starting to change. And today as well, hairdressers opening, the cemeteries too opening for visitors again. So big changes happening very quickly and being promoted by a mayor who until now had been extremely cautious because the infection rate here still remains pretty high.
Sarah Rainsford. 2 years after North and South Korea opened up unprecedented lines of communication, Kim Jong-un's state media has announced the shutdown of all official channels. The newsreader said South Korea had only aroused our dismay and referred to it as the enemy. Pyongyang has been angered by anti-regime leaflets being flown over the border by North Korean defectors in the south. Our Seoul correspondent Laura Bicker told me more.
They inflate these large helium balloons and underneath they attach things like leaflets, which are pretty angry leaflets when it comes to the North Korean regime, some not very flattering to Kim Jong-un. Sometimes they'll attach wee USB sticks with information about the latest news in South Korea, the kind of life that they live in South Korea, news from around the world, because of course North Korea is closed off to the rest of the world. But it's always angered Pyongyang. And it seems that now it has tipped them over the edge, and they've said that there will be no communication hotlines. This is a military hotline, the liaison office hotline, and the key one between Kim Jong-un and President Moon. These were hard-won, hard-fought-for concessions that were agreed to, and now all those ties are severed.
Yeah, the hotline, it conjures up Cold War mental images of a big red military-looking telephone. But what does it actually mean for relations between the two sides?
Well, for years, the two sides could only talk to each other if there was a real emergency. So I think when it comes to communication, it was key that they felt that there was ever a mishap, especially, for instance, just last month, bullets were fired from a North Korean guard post that hit a South Korean guard post. It's the kind of thing that between the military hotlines, the leader of the military hotline here in South Korea can phone the hotline in the north and they can sort it out between them and know that, by the way, that was an accident. But without it, it's unclear, you know, how the two sides are going to communicate.
It wasn't so long ago that Kim Jong-un was having summits with Donald Trump. The mood really has changed.
I mean, we're talking just last year. You were seeing Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un meet one another at the DMZ. Again, you might remember Donald Trump even stepping into North Korea. Everything was jovial. There were handshakes and smiles all round. But certainly things soured after the Hanoi summit. Things went awry there. I think there was real hope on the North Korean side that a deal could be done. My understanding is that the two sides, the United States and North Korea, did come close to doing a deal, but it was scuppered at the last minute. And I think when it comes to Kim Jong-un, he returned to North Korea without the hoped for and longed for deal. And I think perhaps he felt humiliated slightly. And since then, there has been very little communication, certainly with the US and hardly any with Seoul.
Laura Bicker. Still to come in this podcast, a 10 million meal milestone for one Michelin-starred chef who's feeding the needy in India.
Every time we have a successful delivery, I'll put the music full volume in my apartment in New York and I'll be dancing. I said, we did it!
So far, Africa seems to have been less severely impacted by the coronavirus pandemic than other continents. But is that because the virus is still in its early stages there, or have the figures been underreported? In Nigeria, the health minister says up to 60% of nearly 1,000 unexplained deaths in the northern state of Kano were probably due to COVID-19. Richard Hamilton reports.
Officially, Nigeria has recorded only 361 deaths and nearly 13,000 coronavirus cases. But with low testing rates and the largest population in Africa, nearly 200 million, these figures are likely to represent just a fraction of the true picture. The health minister, Osage Haniri, said that a fact-finding team deployed to Kano confirmed that there were 979 additional deaths in the state capital in April and early May. These were mostly elderly people with pre-existing health conditions. Some died in hospital, but more than half died at home. He said that about 600 of these were probably from COVID-19. The medical teams were sent there after grave diggers told local media they were burying far more bodies than usual. The team then gathered information from records at cemeteries and what they called verbal autopsy, i.e. word of mouth. There have been reports of similar unexplained deaths in several other states across the north of the country. Nigeria has been crippled by decades of underinvestment in its healthcare and a global supply of equipment and medicine that seems to have largely excluded developing countries. Doctors say many Nigerians do not understand asymptomatic transmission, and this has fueled conspiracy theories about the virus. Economists think that coronavirus could not have come at a worse time for Nigeria, which is yet to recover from a recession caused by the global economic depression and a slump in crude oil prices.
Richard Hamilton. Earlier, we heard about the ongoing protests for racial justice in the US sparked by the death of George Floyd. Now, the tech giant IBM has said it will no longer offer or develop facial recognition software for use in what it called racial profiling and mass surveillance. Peter Goffin has the details.
The company wrote a letter to the U.S. Congress saying it is time now for a national discussion about the way this technology is being used by police. The company said it will not condone any use of facial recognition software that violates its own principles or human rights more broadly, and that includes mass surveillance and, as you mentioned, racial profiling. Now, that seems to be a reference to the fact that facial recognition programs built in the U.S. are notoriously inaccurate when it comes to non-white faces. In fact, between 10 and 100 times less accurate, according to some research. That's because these algorithms were created using mostly photos of white people as test subjects. And the risk here is that the program could come up with a false positive. Essentially, police are comparing the images of suspects to a database of photos. And if the suspect is black, say, the system might just flag a different black person, an innocent person. And other companies like Microsoft have already said they will not provide the technology to police specifically for that reason.
So this seems quite relevant to the discussion going on in the US. Are worries, though, about mass surveillance higher because of the protests?
Almost certainly. Now, there have always been privacy concerns about facial recognition software, and the worst-case scenario that is always pointed to is China, where the authorities use facial recognition to track political dissidents and even members of persecuted ethnic minorities like the Uyghur Muslims. So now in the U.S., where there's a growing state crackdown on protesters, there's a fear that demonstrators could be tracked and punished. So, look, none of these concerns are new. IBM may have wanted to make this announcement anyway, but these protests are giving it an added urgency.
Peter Goffin. In 2016, Sweden clamped down on immigration, making it much more difficult for asylum seekers. The previous year, more than 160,000 people had arrived in the country hoping to stay. Of those, around a fifth were unaccompanied minors. And this month, the first few have been graduating from high school. A new law, known as the High School Law, was brought in to help them and other unaccompanied minors to settle legally as adults. They have to get a job within 6 months. But with COVID-19 adding to concern over job prospects, many say they're facing an uncertain future. Matilda Whelan reports.
I am listening to a reading of a short story by Ali Zardadi, who came to Sweden from Afghanistan as an unaccompanied minor. Ali tells me it's about yearning for distant family.
It's mainly about missing mom. And then, well, I think most people would recognize it if I say that it's incredibly hard to relax and to get any proper sleep. I don't know, it may be because you miss your family. It may be because your future is so uncertain.
Ali lives in Stockholm and his Swedish is fluent. But if he doesn't find a permanent job within 6 months of finishing school, he has to leave.
It's like a giant challenge waiting for me straight after graduation day. I don't know what my life will be like next year. It was hard even before Corona, but now it has become worse.
The high school law was designed to give people like Ali the right to stay in Sweden once they turn 18. But it has numerous conditions, and those who arrived as unaccompanied minors without identity papers are not covered.
I would hope that I can start working right away.
Ruth Said is 19 years old and lives in Norrköping, about 2 hours south of Stockholm. She arrived from Ethiopia in 2011. Like Ali, she has just finished school and speaks fluent Swedish. She doesn't have any official papers, though, and so cannot use the high school law to stay. But under Swedish legislation, she cannot be deported either.
Kind of sounds ridiculous to think that somebody you have spent so much money and all these things for, like for them to go to school and everything, and then now that they have finally done everything that needs to be done, and it's time for them to start paying the taxes and give back to the community that gave you the chance to go to school and everything, and that's when you get stopped. It's kind of like, I don't know, it doesn't sound like a good business either.
Det ger ju, öppnar ju risken för handel med anställningskontrakt.
In April, the Swedish parliament debated whether to relax the high school law because of coronavirus and its effects on the job market. That will be controversial for critics who say the law is already allowing people with no recognized protection issues to stay in the country. The government says it has no plans to change the law for now.
Matilda Whelan. Saarbrücken will make history today when they become the first team from the fourth tier of German football to play in the semi-final of the Cup. They take on the Bundesliga side Bayer Leverkusen. And just to make the challenge even more daunting, Saarbrücken haven't played a match in 3 months. More from Alex Capstick.
The last time Saarbrücken played a game of football was 94 days ago. The lower leagues in Germany have been cancelled as a result of the global pandemic. In contrast, the Bundesliga resumed a few weeks ago. Bayer Leverkusen have 5 matches under their belt. The most recent was at the weekend, when they lost to Bayern Munich. Saarbrücken's advance to the last 4 of the cup competition has been extraordinary. Teams at their level have to qualify just to take part. But despite their underdog status, along the way they managed to record dramatic victories against 2 top-flight clubs, Cologne and Fortuna Düsseldorf. In Germany, apart from the final, fourth division sides always get home advantage. Not that any of them have ever progressed this far. So at least the players will be on familiar territory. But of course, because of COVID, their small stadium in Saarland near the French border will be empty. And the players have been in quarantine for the past week. They appear to be realistic about reaching the final. One said they had no chance, while the coach, Lukas Kasniok, compared the possibility of winning with the rebirth of Jesus Christ. The odds are stacked against them. Victory would be sensational. But while they might be out of match practice, it's perhaps wise not to completely discount it.
Alex Capstick. New York-based chef Vikas Khanna is celebrating after hitting a 10 million meal milestone in his quest to provide meals to those impacted by the coronavirus in his home country of India. He almost gave up on his plans back in April after some rations were stolen. He told Claire McDonnell what got him started on the ambitious plan.
I got a spam email, like a kind of a newsletter of a foundation, which was demanding for money because they said, you know, after the lockdown in India, there's going to be a lot of issue of food. So I just donated some cash there. And suddenly it hit me that most of the places like orphanages, old age home, leprosy centers, they do not stock too much of dry ration. They live day to day. And it suddenly struck me that there's going to be a very major issue of food supply chain being interrupted. And that is when we started doing small deliveries in India. And on April 10th, I guess, I got badly scammed by somebody. I paid them and my truck of ration disappeared and I got demoralized. I called my mom in the morning and told her I can't be doing this initiative. It's not easy because there are a lot of challenges. And she gets upset with me and she says, just remember, for almost 50 years, my country, my people have trained you to become a Michelin star chef. And it's your duty to serve them when they need you. And I don't want to hear all these excuses. And I'm like, I'm sorry I called you in the morning. Literally, that was my answer.
It's what you needed, though. It's what you needed. Your mum put you back on track. So
I was whining all the time. It's so difficult. It's so difficult. I can't do it. And she bursted all her anger on me. She's saying, my country is the one which gave you every dish you cooked and you made all your name and Michelin stars. You do not tell this thing to me ever again that you can't do this. It's difficult because you have to stand in the battlefield and actually feed the people.
Well, it was the pep talk you needed because after that demoralizing start, you've got back on track. And how many people have you managed to feed now?
We crossed 10 million people, which is cooked meals and dry ration meals, both together. And yesterday afternoon at 4 o'clock, we crossed that number.
Goodness me. Why is hunger such an emotive issue for you?
You know, I lived through extreme instable moments in my life in India. And of course, when I came to New York, I did not have a plan. So I ended up in homeless shelters and all those places. And I realized that hunger was something which is very emotional to me because I didn't grow up in a rich family kind of. And so this hurt me when I saw the images. My relatability and my compassion was very real, which broke my heart very deeply. And I said, you know, today I have the opportunity. I have enough resources, not to feed people, enough resources to put people together so we can feed them together. So every time we have a successful delivery, I'll put the music full volume in my apartment in New York and I'll be dancing. I said, we did it. It's a small victory, but we did it. We promised someone and we reached there.
Michelin-starred chef Vikas Khanna. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Miriam.
I think about our neighbours. About what they think of us clearing their land.
But is it their land?
And Yusuf.
Until you came, this is our part of Jerusalem.
Two lives lived during the founding of Israel.
Will you stomach this humiliation one day longer?
A podcast drama from the BBC World Service.
Prepare for that battle. Over Jerusalem in the valley, over all of Eretz Israel.
Miriam and Yusuf.
How did we get here? We could be friends.
Search for Miriam and Yusuf. That's MIRIAM and YOUSSEF. Wherever you get your podcasts.